Pardon the interruption, but I'm Mike Wilbon. Tony, today is Alien Abduction Day. You ever been snatched by aliens?
I'm Tony Kornheiser once. Being probed kind of tickles a little bit.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
What were they using, a feather duster?
No. Some of them had claws, Some of them had those things that you use to put the logs on the fire. As you can imagine, they all came from Uranus.
Yeah, all right. We don't need that.
It's a joke we can make
Stay
all
away
the
from
time.
That.
Now, to jump back into the really weird stuff, and to tie it into this in a way, I made this point when I was on Project Archivist about a couple weeks ago, and I guess it's sort of like you can kind of hang your hat on this if you're into the UFO thing, and you know, I kind of poked at some of these more far-out theories in a sense, but if you look at it, they didn't really know anything about germs until rather recently in human history, right?
Right.
So all along there was this whole thing existing alongside of us for hundreds, thousands of years that no one even knew about, and then they figured it out. So there's a possibility that, you know, that's all it's going to take, and we'll realize, oh, it's been here all along, but it's this.
Yeah, I love that idea. Seriously, I heard that episode, by the way.
Oh, cool.
And so I listen to Archivist all the time.
Yeah, it's a good show.
I think that's an excellent way to look at it. And if you want to think about science and where we are, how many times did you ask me tonight about something and I'd say, well, I don't know. And this is what I tell the students all the time is that I'm going to make you a little bit uncomfortable because you'll see that very quickly I can take you right to the edge of what we know, and you're going to realize that what we don't know is infinitely more vast. We've had remarkable accomplishment in the last 300 years, for example, in science and engineering. Remarkable. But what lies beyond is far more vast than what we've really covered. And one of my professors told me that, you know, Tyler, that really the questions basically remain the same. Our answers change, but the fundamental questions remain the same. And I think that, you know, you look at it and you just have to back up and say, yes, there will be future discoveries. Quantum mechanics is great, but guess what? Most of that was put together before we realized there was this dark energy and dark matter. And so we've described 5% of the universe. And it's just stunning when you think about how little we know. So the thing that I would say is, I really like that idea, but I talked to Jeff Ritzman about this, and one of the things that you have to be careful about as a scientist is that you have to be very careful not to mistake yourself for God and think that you know everything or you can explain everything.
Right.
This is what I think a lot of people get upset about, and they say, well, debunkers come in and they have the answer. I think that is, unfortunately, sometimes correct. And I would say that if people are coming in and they feel like they have to explain everything and they have to have an answer and they have to trash other explanations, that's not the spirit of debunking. That's definitely not the spirit of science.
Right. It's like there needs to be an embracing of not just I don't know, maybe from the skeptics, but perhaps on the other side, on the paranormalist side, there needs to be also this idea that I could be wrong.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, I think no one ever acknowledges the fact that they could be wrong.
I think you're right.
So that's a problem, I think, you know.
Well, you know, one of the things that happens is on some of the venues, it becomes like a cage match. And that the one person must prevail. And so you get into this situation where, you know, I'm right, you're wrong, and it goes back and forth and we don't get anywhere. And so what I would look for is somebody that would say something like, well, you know what, here's what we could do. Or I think this doesn't work because, but you might look at it this way. If you get into those kind of conversations, it'd be so much more productive. And that's what I think we've kind of missed in some ways too frequently. But yeah, God, I love that germ theory idea. That is great.
Well, thanks. You can keep run with it, man.
Yeah, there's two things. So.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
In light of all this talk about DNA and everything, One of the things that the people in the paranormal community always hang their hat on is this junk DNA thing. They're always like, oh, there's all this junk DNA, and something in there is going to end up being, you know, the key to all this, or all that stuff. You know, they're always sort of like this junk DNA. Junk DNA is sort of always used as this MacGuffin of possibility down the line. You know, but I don't know anything about junk DNA, and I presume you know something about it. So, you know, what is the makeup of this junk DNA? And is it really possibly containing some kind of secret that, you know, could connect to aliens or anything like that?
Well, that's a kind of a good question, and I guess the people would say, you know, what is the function of junk DNA? And we can come back and say, well, we know that it doesn't really do proteins. But and it varies very quickly compared to the true coding sequences for proteins that can't just change willy-nilly without some kind of consequences. But the $64 billion question is, my God, now does junk DNA do something? And in fact, people are finding, yeah, it has more functionality and more import to it than we had previously thought of it. And to call it junk DNA was probably not a good idea, not a good name. So it may be target sites for things like enhancer functions that express other genes, or it may help it fold properly. Will we find signals in there? You bet. Okay. And one of the things we're doing right now is you know, the Human Genome Project.
Mm-hmm.
There's a thing called genome-wide association studies that look for how markers, mutations link to various disease states, for example. Now we're on the 10,000 gene or 1,000 genome project, and we're trying to get how much human variation there is, with an idea of looking for, can we find the markers of diseases? And I suspect that a lot of them are going to show up in what we call junk DNA.
Hmm.
And the other thing that is kind of fun to think about is, maybe you've heard about the Personal Genome Project?
No, but I'm going to leap to the conclusion that it's something that you can get your own genome done.
Yes, and more to the point, post it on the World Wide Web.
Weird. I've heard of like people who outsource their genome now to, when they're sick. There's a guy, you know, he's sick, so he got his genome done and put it online so other people could look to see if they could figure out how to help him.
Yeah. Well, these guys, and you know what? There's a logic to that. If, you know, the chips are really down and you're hoping against hope for some kind of miracle, maybe that's a good thing to do.
Yeah.
But the Personal Genome Project was something launched by a very, very brilliant scientist at Harvard. His name's George Church. And he got into trouble over the idea of cloning Neanderthals. But this guy is a leader in terms of genome analysis technology, where we're going, all that stuff. He's at the forefront. And what they did is, one of the things he foresaw is stuff being available on the computer with full histories. And so that data is very important, potentially very valuable. But they posted their entire sequence on there. Okay. The problem with that is that somebody, me, for example, could nose through that and find out things about them I really shouldn't know. And the other problem with it is that we do not, as a group, understand what the sequences tell us. We don't know how to read the whole story. In 20 years, we're going to know more. And that data could be very, very damaging to the person. We don't know good or bad or whatever's in there. But you're taking a risk that no one can quantify and no one can even put parameters to by putting it out there publicly. And I'd say, whoa, that's a big mistake. But eventually we are getting back to the idea of junk DNA. It ain't junk. And at some point we're going to learn how to read it a lot better and we're going to find out things.
Hmm.
And I hope to hell that what we find out is not damaging to these people. What we really need are good rules about privacy and how to take care of our sequences. And that's one of the things that I hope the Banal Think Tank can really get into, is getting people educated about how DNA works, what to look out for, and if you are a hybrid, for God's sake, work with an investigator that you trust, you know, because that information could be your life, literally. One of the things that if you're interested, you could look on the New York Times about an article, Steven Pinker, who who's in the Personal Genome Project published called My DNA, Myself, and he goes through kind of what he went through. But one of the things that I think that he said, and I know others have said, is, oh, gosh, I don't want to know about this gene called APOE. I don't want to know which one I have. And the reason that he declined to know that was that it would possibly reveal your risk for Alzheimer's disease. And so he just doesn't want to know.
Okay, yeah, I was going to ask you, what is this, what are these, first of all, what are these horrifying things that you could find out so I don't avoid them? And second, you said if someone's a hybrid, they need to be very careful because it could cost, how could it cost them their life?
Well, not necessarily cost them their life, but you're going to tell me, if you're a hybrid and you come in and allow me to do all the sequence information, I've got all kinds of interesting goodies on you.
Oh, so like so I can find out you're allergic to peanuts or something like that, and then, you know, if we have a dispute over the payment, I could just, like, put a peanut in your sandwich.
Yeah. Well, you actually hit on something good. We could prevent...
Sometimes I do.
We could avoid... You could save the person's life. But let's just say, for example, like Dr. Pinker, I don't want to know my APOE status because I don't really want to know I'm at risk for Alzheimer's. I'd say that's probably... I mean, it's fine. That's his decision. I would want to know so that, just like you said, I could take steps to... do everything possible to protect myself, like stop eating Big Macs, Ding Dongs, Ho-Hos, Twinkies, all the things I love, okay, to try to protect myself. But the other thing that's kind of more interesting to think about is, well, let's say that you decide you want to get long-term health care insurance because now you know your odds for developing Alzheimer's disease are substantially higher than average.
Ah, I see. So you're an at-risk applicant.
Yeah. So I go ahead and I type in your name and I go, oh, Steven Pinker, APOE4. Thank you. We decline. That's where those things can get to be really interesting and really sticky. Or a job applicant, for example. Now, this is at the moment. I'm not clear about the legalities. This is why I say be really cautious because I don't know what the Genetic Non-Discrimination Act will and will not do in terms of protecting you. But people have been caught attempting to test job applicants and find out what their genotypes were. So if you could get rid of people who would cost your health insurance a whole lot, man, what a you know boon to your company.
See, that's scary because I feel like this whole idea of getting that information on people is like a runaway train.
Well,
I don't feel like there's the safeguards in place to actually prevent that before it's overtaken the marketplace, if you will.
Well, the other thing is that if you want to have a chill go down your spine, it is kind of fun to listen to the really high-powered scientists like Dr. Church because one of the things that he was talking about with Neanderthal cloning was he recognized immediately, I'm paraphrasing, but roughly the conversation with Der Spiegel, the magazine, the article that kind of got him into trouble was, well, you could clone Neanderthals, but that wouldn't be permitted. I mean, he immediately came back and clarified the rules and regulations don't allow that, and that's true. And then he came back, and I think it was in the same article, but at some point, I believe, maybe in his book, but the laws can be changed. Well, isn't that interesting? And yes, they can. So there is a Genetic Non-Discrimination Act right now, but you know how dedicated Congress is to protecting all of us. And I just think, you know, you saw how Main Street versus Wall Street went with the financial crisis. I can't imagine that special interests wouldn't have a way to get the information they want when it becomes available. I'm just kind of pessimistic that way, but I don't trust our politicians to protect us. So, you know,
well, isn't it also the case where don't they take DNA from, like, prisoners all the time? So they already have they could already have a huge database on this stuff anyway.
Oh, no, they do. It's called CODIS. And that is the national profiles. Now, these are profiles, not genomic sequences.
Could they take the profiles? Like, do they have the access to that information, though, down the line?
Yeah.
Or is that stuff like on file where they could get the genome from the other stuff?
It is, in fact, on file, and it's used. So if you have, now the argument right now before the Supreme Court is, when can you take, I think, the samples? Could it be taken? I think right now it's after conviction that you have to be a convicted criminal. But I could be wrong on this. I'd have to, somebody will have to check me
right.
on this.
It's probably like that's the debate, right? Or could it be like at the point of arrest?
At the point of arrest. And so, you know, when do your privacy rights kick in? When is it reasonable for the state to intercede? And of course, there's an idea that, you know, you really literally could take dangerous people off the streets quickly or quicker by this particular method. And you can tie them back to samples that have come from crime scenes and then go work backwards to be sure that you really do have a good match. But the question becomes, at what point can you sample? At what rights of privacy expectations do you have? I mean, I've heard tales of people who have been offered a Coke at an interrogation, for example, and they just took the can and swabbed that for a profile. And this is the kind of power that you have. Cigarette butts, for example. All those things are possibilities now. That people don't realize how powerful these technologies are and how much data they can give us. But there actually is a crime base called CODIS, and it's been around for a while. It has thousands of profiles in it already.
Well, like I said about the marketplace, that's the scary part because I feel like there's such a – you're talking about an amazing wealth of data, right?
Right.
And there's just – it's like a law of supply and demand. Like that, data is the ultimate currency, it seems, nowadays. So the marketplace somehow will will force it out. Will force, you know, this to become like one of the next ubiquitous things. Maybe like in 50 years, you know. I'm afraid they're going to Trojan horse this in on people.
It will. This is the. It's coming fast, but it comes incrementally.
Hmm.
And this is the thing that when George Church says, "Oh, we could clone a Neanderthal," not really. But new technologies are going to be on us so quickly, and we're going to have to cope with them and make decisions in the very near term. I'm telling you, it's going to be unbelievable. I mean, we talk about revolution. This is an area where the term revolution is very apt. You know, the DNA technology has turned the legal system upside down. People have kind of not digested this yet, but if you think about it, you've heard of the Innocence Project?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And they I think, right now say roughly 170 people, convicted felons, some of whom were on death row, have been exonerated. And I think world or U.S.-wide in total, not just the Innocence Project, but other like projects,
yeah.
Over 300 people convicted, 18 on death row, and these convictions were thrown out. So what's happened is the DNA evidence has really shown us that bedrock ideas of evidence, witness reliability, all those things, they're all basically, we don't know what the heck's going on anymore. This is just the beginning. Just the beginning of what these technologies are going to do. It's just really hard to imagine how much our lives are going to change. But if you can remember back 20 years ago as to what computer technology was like compared to what it's like today, you're going to be seeing kind of the same thing with biological technology and synthetic biology. And some of it has just started to come on the scene. And so I can't even tell you what the potentialities are other than to say that they'll be mind-boggling.
Jesus. I knew you were intense, but I didn't know you were this intense.
Well, it's stuff that's it's fun to think about.
It, absolutely, yeah, yeah. It's like, why do you need to be scared about aliens being time travelers or living inside the Earth when we're doing worse stuff? Worse stuff's already unfolding right around us.
Well, that's what Rogan and Lobo on Project Archivist are always saying to me. It's like, man, wait a minute, this stuff is real.
Yeah, exactly.
It is. And so we've got a lot to do, and that's where I would say that whether you like it or not, Paratopia, Project Archivist, but all of America, you're educators. And one of the things that you're doing is helping people try to cope with data and teaching them really how to be scientists. And I can't think of anything more essential because you got so many things coming down on you, or we do as a society. I don't even know which way to turn first.
Yeah, especially with the internet. We're getting bombarded.
Well, you know, it's a great tool, but boy, there are so many things that happened that we hadn't anticipated. One of which was a group of scientists showed how they were able to actually figure out from DNA profile and other evidence, including those ancestry services,
yeah,
who the donors were. This was never supposed to happen. It was all supposed to be private, completely private. And this group just went through and they took, I think, 22 and they figured out who 18 of them were. Almost precisely 18. I mean, they had them nailed by name.
See, this is like worse than fingerprints because I don't know.
Fingerprints are nothing.
Yeah. That's the fingerprint doesn't tell anybody about anything, you know, about the person at all. Just, it's just like a barcode. You know? This is like an uncoded barcode. Scary.
This is as the technology has evolved, the capabilities are astonishing, and what people can do. And then if you think about it, how inventive people are, there will be things that no one has really foreseen yet. And so the guy is taking and cracking the identity codes of people who had basically participated in studies. Completely not foreseen, except a few people had. They had warned about it, but they didn't think anybody would do it. And now with better computing facilities, boom, there it was.
Now, how come it's illegal to clone the Neanderthal? Because it gets into too human a realm?
Yes. In fact, if you defined a Neanderthal as not human, which would be kind of a stretching it, you might be able to get away with it. But even then, it would be pretty difficult. Dr. Church is being a little facetious, I think, when he's saying you could do that or it won't be long. It's not an easy job. And one of the things is that we don't have a good consensus sequence for the Neanderthals. But the rules for reproductive cloning for humans are very clear. It's not allowed. And President Obama specifically reiterated that recently, saying that it's immoral and has no justification. I mean, he really just basically made it very clear what the federal government's take on that was. So in the U.S., no, not allowed. Elsewhere, probably the bulk of the countries that do research like we do, not allowed. But other places, maybe not so clear. So on some island in the Pacific, maybe somebody would be able to get away with it. Reproductive human cloning.
I'm sure it's happening somewhere.
Well,
I don't know necessarily actually, though, because you need some pretty serious minded and skilled scientists to pull that kind of thing off. So chances are, you know, you'd have to start from scratch. You know, it's kind of like building a nuclear weapon, right? I mean, you know,
yeah.
If North Korea wants to start cloning humans, they better find some people that can actually do that.
It's, as you say, it's not something that is developed at this point. In principle, you know, I mean, one of the things that I tell students is that the theory is sometimes the easiest thing. The actual know-how is a lot more difficult. So taking a nucleus out of a cell, slipping it into an enucleated ovum, and getting that thing to grow properly, that's not, I mean, it's easy to say. It's a little bit harder. It's a lot harder to do. So I think you're right that the technical aspects of it probably preclude that. But I'll also tell you that we've had Dolly the sheep. I don't know if you remember her.
Oh, yeah.
And then did you hear about Cece for copycat?
No. Is that a copy?
Kitten.
Oh. Yeah, I've heard people cloning their I've heard of people cloning their pets.
Yes. And then I don't know if this might give people pause. When they clone them, as with copycat, she was a calico.
Mm-hmm.
They don't look anything like the original. Because the color patterns and everything on the calicos are random events where genes are basically shut off at certain times, and it just kind of happens stochastically. And so the idea that you're going to get a little Tim Bunnell, for example, yeah, pretty much, sort of, kind of, we don't know because, you know, maybe in utero your mom was eating Cheetos, and so that explains you. And so then, you know, like.
Right, we don't know all the factors. Yeah, yeah.
We don't. So trying to get the exact thing, not so easy.
And yeah, it sounds pretty impossible, yeah.
Well, this was explored in the Boys from Brazil, if you remember that movie with Gregory Peck.
Yeah.
And the book. Yeah. Yeah, they wanted to reproduce Hitler. And they came up with, they tried to basically reproduce his environment, recognizing that genes were only part of it. And the thing about the genome code is that that's only potentials. The environment is what's going to finally bring those out, or not. Or not. So with Alzheimer's disease, APOE4, we know that it increases your chances dramatically, but some people have the APOE4 gene and never get Alzheimer's disease. And so there are factors that still elude us. They're only potentials.
The scary part, in a way, is you kind of wonder, they could twist it around, is my fear, where they're going to be like, listen, now you have to give us this stuff so we can treat you, to so we can stop this. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
I'm afraid that's kind of the fear of it. Like, and you know, and then they use that to do all kinds of other nefarious things.
It's true that you could couch it in terms of, we're only trying to help.
Huh.
We're trying to help you avoid things. And one of the things that was done with the federal government is the Genetic Non-Discrimination Act was put together specifically so that people could have testing done with some kind of confidence that it wouldn't be used against them. I'm not clear, though, on what happens if, for example, you go to another service outside of your ordinary medical doctor, for example, and try to find out, like, well, gosh, does my kid have an APOE4 gene so that I should not let him play contact sports? How that information can or be accessed or protected or not protected, I'm not clear on the rules. And so there could be a lot of things that people will find out the hard way. And you're right, there could be things that people realize there are opportunities and they start to tweak it. And we're just kind of there.
Well, that's the whole thing, too, about, you know, this. Then you get into also the possibility of, like, eugenics and stuff. You know, because you talk about people who, you know, I've seen sort of the glowing articles where it's like, someday you'll be able to choose your baby's eye color and stuff like that. You know, it's like, but why, you know, don't do that. You shouldn't be, I don't think we should be doing that kind of thing.
Right now, as a society, I think that the law is on your side, that people have agreed that reproductive cloning and changing germlines are things that we do not want to do. And I don't see that changing very soon. But going in and maybe making changes that could help us avoid heart disease or strengthen failing cardiac muscles, for example, if we have the ability to put genes or express genes in cells, as I think we will shortly through basically gene transfer mechanisms, those are probably going to come and could be important medical adjuncts. So, I mean, there's so many ways this can go and so many things that could develop that we can't even foresee yet, that we need to be very clear as best we can that people need to understand what's going on. And to me, this is the only hope. If we can't educate people, anything can happen. And the more eyeballs there are on it, and the more people discussing it on the Internet, and the more people who might get enraged when something really outrageous is done, could make all the difference.
Yeah, that's true. You know, the court of public opinion, if you will.
Yes.
You know, because if all of a sudden people, you know, if for some odd reason people didn't seem to have a problem with human cloning, it would be already happening.
Well, you know, that's an interesting thing that you brought up, because one of the things that is in George Church's book is kind of what he sees as the progression of acceptance of technology. And he gives an example of basically the techniques to help people conceive babies that couldn't before, the in vitro fertilization protocols.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, at first that was violently opposed, and then as the technology matured and developed and we could do it without too much trouble, people began doing it, and then the objections declined, and so now it's free for all. Not quite. Okay, there's about 1.2 billion Catholics in the world who probably have a few things to say about in vitro fertilization, and it's not necessarily all positive. And so, yeah, some of the objections have waned. Certainly laws and restrictions have been limited, But to say everybody's on board or there's no objection, oh, I don't think so. He needs to get out more.
I guess it's talked about now in a way. You know what I mean? It's, maybe it's not.
It is.
Like shunned.
It is, and I agree with him that as the technology has matured, you can get people to have basically the embryos put in there that will implant without having to destroy mass quantities of embryos. Although I think it's still, some people find the whole process to be pretty objectionable. It depends on when you feel that human life begins. You know, I mean, those are matters of faith and not necessarily science, but yeah, I mean, people do, see it as, on the average as more acceptable, and the laws have been changed to reflect that. So, I mean, this is where we are.
Oddly enough, the word embryo got me thinking of, another piece that you have on your YouTube page, which folks just Google, Tyler Kochjohn to find his YouTube page or punch in Rewinky, R-E-W-I-N-K-Y. That'll bring you up to his stuff. But what I thought was interesting that I guess I should have just assumed it or presumed it and not expected the people in the abduction research field to mention it. But you say that if a woman was actually, you know, inseminated with a hybrid, you know, if they put a hybrid in her or something like that and then took it out, that, you know, that's a prevalent story in the hybrid mythos.
Yes.
Then it should be able to be proven medically.
Yes.
And
it will leave traces.
And then in turn, I'm sure it must be tremendously traumatic for these women, whether it actually happened or not. So I can understand there'd be a difficulty maybe in rounding up the evidence. But it's been like 30 years, I think, since this whole kind of concept came out. So you'd think by now there would be a comprehensive study or work done to either flesh this out or show that we can't seem to find any actual physical evidence for this to have happened.
I agree. The ability to detect the cells from the baby. It turns out that mom and baby exchange cells, and some of them live on in mom for decades after the pregnancy. Under some circumstances, for example, obviously mom's going to be female, but if you go through and track and find male cells in her, you know where they came from. And it's possible, it's feasible to do that, and in fact now, in the last few years, one could even do that from a simple blood draw. That we can, now the sequencing technologies are powerful enough that people are actually proposing looking for markers of mutations that you don't want to see in the baby by doing a blood draw instead of amniocentesis, which is a little more dangerous. And so these things the technology has come along so fast and so furiously that, yeah, now there's a possibility. And if you go back and think about the cells, hanging on, the embryonic cells hanging on in mom, that was unsuspected until about 20 years ago. And then the data just became overwhelming that, in fact, those cells had migrated. And it may have consequences for things like arthritis and other diseases later on in mom's life. So it could be done. It's not necessarily easy, but as time goes on, the sequencing stuff could be quick and relatively easy, depending on when you caught them. If they were in the middle of an event and had an implantation, it would be easy. And if they were a few days after, a week after or so, you could still find the traces of the DNA in circulation, in mom's circulation. Mm-hmm. There's lots of possibilities now that didn't exist 20 years ago. I agree that it might be hard. And this is one of the challenges I pose to Dr. Jacobs is, okay, how much effort is it worth, Dave? We got a nefarious, I guess, conspiracy against all of humanity. Might be worth a reasonable effort to see what's going on. I mean, you know, I'm just being silly now.
No, but it's, if you believe it, if you adamantly, if that's your bailiwick, then you should do what it takes to prove it. So
that was my point. It's right. The extreme frustration that I had with these guys. That I guess if I was him, I wouldn't talk to me either. To tell you the truth, because I'm just going to create problems. But this is what I'd say is that there are things that could be done and situations that are out there that would help you understand, is this real or is this not? And if it's not, then what is it that people are experiencing? I personally believe that part of the problem, if you want to think about it, is hypnotic suggestion. However, I think we can tease that out too. And I'm not sure, you know, I mean, if you look at the work of Whitley Strieber and now Project Core, it's clear to me that not everybody needs to be hypnotized. And there are lots of people that just remember their experiences.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And so we can look at that group, which I think was significantly underexploited by Hopkins and a whole series of people after that. So,
right,
I think there are plenty of things that could be done, plenty of approaches that are now possible that weren't before, and we can get after this.
You know, it's frustrating in a sense because you feel like the paranormal community, whether it's UFOs or Bigfoot or whatever, they never really go to the skeptics and just be like, well, what do you need? You know, what can we do? What can we provide you that you know, that will help? It seems
some
it's always
do.
Like, I guess, yeah. Some do. Some do. Not enough.
Well, that's what I always say. And or not, I guess, completely enough, you want to think of it that way. It's not like, well, yeah, give me a couple of good ideas and you go do what you want anyway. But there are a few people who will follow the leads. If you think about... there have been a couple of investigators who I think have had the right idea. And Bill Schalker, mm-hmm. Hair of the Alien,
yep.
is probably the first guy, at least as far as I can tell, the first guy to recognize the potential power of DNA evidence to answer the question. And what did he do? He went right after it. And he got a good case, and he did everything he could do. He got all the data, and he showed what he had. And so, my gosh. That's a great effort. That's the spirit. And so I think, you know, there's your example to emulate.
Yeah. And, too often the attitude is like, huh, we'll disprove this. When it really should be like, hey, here's something interesting. What do you think of this? You know, what can I go back and get more of? What do I need? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Cooperation. Yeah. What's so hard about that?
Well, it's become quite an issue. And I think, you know, like we're talking about camps and how, I think what you've termed it is how can I fortify the interactions between those. And I'd say it's going to have to come one bit at a time. But, you know, Guy Edwards and other people, Sharon Hill, people who are willing to have a discussion and give and take. And I think when folks get the idea that that works, they'll follow along. And I can tell you honestly, what I saw after your interview with Sharon Hill was a lot of people saw the value because they immediately began to include her. And that was something that she had mentioned, like, well, you know, I never get invited to these things. And so I'm hoping that, you know, maybe you broke that barrier. It kind of looks like it might have started. I hope it continues.
Yeah, I'm seeing her a lot more now that she's been on the show, but I don't want to pat myself too much on the back for that.
Well, I'll do it. That was good. It was, and that's why I sent you the email. And what people don't know is that we hadn't really talked to each other directly, even though kind of indirectly, because I heard, just like you say, you hear about this or that, and I would always hear from Vaney about things that you said.
Yeah, we have a lot of good mutual friends.
Yeah, and so what I did is when I listened to that episode, of course, I was very curious to hear it, and I thought, this was great. And so when I think people do things well, you should tell them.
No, thank you.
That's why I sent the email. But, yeah, I think, you know, it'd be great if you'd have her back on and find out, hey, how did it really break for you? Did anything happen? Did other people get in touch? Because I know that they have. And then did that mean that you finally got invited to another, like, you know, UFO Congress 2014, something like that. And that would be wonderful.
I think it would be great if there was more skeptics of these events, but, you know, in a lot of ways, a lot of these things are driven by star power, and they, in the paranormal field, they have, like, anti-star power. You know what I mean?
Yes.
They're full of dark energy.
it's not for everybody. So you'll have to choose wisely. But I'm telling you, it's no different in science. Our group just ended a collaboration a few months ago with a guy, world authority in the area that we needed, but he just wasn't very workable, and he was kind of unpleasant. And he really gave our group leader a bad time. And so I said, Alex, you know what? It's time for us to move on. And so, you know, you go on to the next person.
Yeah.
And that this same as it is in every place else in life, that some work and some don't.
I also saw a clip that you made called Alien Hybrids Do the Math, which I thought was interesting because it just says pretty much that a hybrid invasion isn't, I guess, statistically feasible. Is that the right way to put it?
Yeah. Yeah, it would be rather difficult. That the numbers don't favor the aliens taking over in such a way. And the reason is with my simple model, that the hybrids really can't reproduce because they'll basically be swamped out by human genes. And so as a reproductive strategy, this seems pretty weak. And so actually, if you think about strategies, the Siskin idea of people coming in and being modified to search for gold, the Anunnaki controlling beings or whatnot to search for gold,
yeah,
is actually a more tenable idea in terms of practicality, that you'd have a cadre of people to work for you. But no, the idea of taking over by that mechanism, I think, is pretty intrinsically weak. And this is what I'd say is when you have a lot of people looking at things and commenting, one of the powerful things with the Internet now is the ability for people to get on sites and comment, and hopefully those comments will be posted and survive, is that these ideas can be kind of found out. And in reality, that's what we do in science is peer review. And so if I want to publish a paper, I have to send it in to a journal, and it has to be reviewed by people anonymous to me who are considered knowledgeable in the field, and they will look at it and see if they can detect any errors. And that can be really important for figuring out, like, oh, my God, yeah, this isn't going to work.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's mathematically impossible. And trust me, all of us, the most brilliant scientists among us, I'm sure, would admit that we've all had ideas that have just been pretty damn bad. And they get shot down, and that's how it should go.
I'm still just stuck on the difficulties facing the UFO field, you know, that we've started this conversation on, and how to get to the bottom of it, how to really, because it's kind of like, I've heard the analogy that it's like weather, you know, where it's hard to really, it's the old thing about how it's not repeatable. So what is the best way to go about getting a handle on something that's not repeatable?
Yeah, I think ephemeral phenomena are obviously difficult.
I mean, do we have previous examples of ephemeral phenomena we've figured out, and maybe what's the template for that?
Absolutely, and one of those is the idea of meteors, rocks falling from the sky, how mm-hmm. preposterous 200 years ago. And then suddenly what people began to do is to witness the falls and bring in rocks that were like nothing else that was in the area and people hadn't seen before. And slowly, bit by bit, and it was not, you know, one rock, you know, now, oh, yeah, okay, National Academy now accepts. But bit by bit, you kind of whittle away at it. And I think I was actually talking on Jeff's show where one of the best tools you can have for some of these phenomena is a sharp eye and a good notebook, and that you just start recording. Okay, I saw on this night a diary, and then you go back and review those, and patterns sometimes kind of fall out.
Right. This is kind of what I was saying about the Nate Silver idea. You know,
yeah.
If we have a huge database of the UFO sightings, put them into this. You know, maybe a statistician needs to look at this stuff.
Well, I'll tell you what, a statistician and a whole bunch of other people besides.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you just, this is the sort of crowdsourcing. But yeah, I mean, if you look at the data, the next thing that will happen, Tim, will be hypotheses. Hey, you know what? This only happens on Tuesdays in Ohio. And then you can be there. Okay? You can get ready. Or if you have, we talked about a hot spot before. But those patterns will, or maybe data, will lead you to testable hypotheses, and you can slowly winnow it down. But I think that it's going to be a very long process, and it may be, quite honestly, that science is not up to answering this in a quick way, or perhaps even some of it not at all. And we try. We get as far as we can. And, you know, it's a tool. Science is a tool, and so sometimes it maybe can help us, sometimes it can't.
Well, see, I find that refreshing that you say that, because I did follow some of the fallout from the Sharon Hill appearance, and one of the sort of arguments that came up between commenters on some of these posts was that, and I guess I'm kind of on the pro paranormal side, where they say, you know, science hasn't done a good job of explaining these things, and then, you know, on the skeptic side, they say, yes, they have. You're just not listening. But like as I said to Sharon on the show, maybe we're all just wrong. Clearly, we're all wrong because we're still fighting about it. So, I mean, part of it is, it feels to me like, how can science not have explained all this by now?
Yeah, I
it shouldn't persist
that.
If the explanations are so airtight, if they're so positive, then it shouldn't be, you know, it should be more like the flat Earth, you know?
Yeah,
no one's jumping on flat Earth anymore.
I think this is part of the problem they're hitting on, is that we individually are polarized, and we're arguing from positions of certainty that actually are not warranted. And that there are times that people need to just work backwards and say, okay, explain to me what you saw, and let's talk about it, or let's go through this, or let's look at the evidence. I look at ghost hunters or ghost hunting as a place that is absolutely rife for people to come in and confirm or reject that certain techniques like EVPs have any kind of basis in actual fact. And I think it can be done. And then we can, if that works, great. And if not, you know, we can stop worrying about it. But, you know, I mean, how cool would it be if it actually would work?
The whole EVP thing in general?
Yeah, I'm not a great subscriber to that. I don't get it. But I think there's things that you can do. There are techniques that I think would help us believe if this is real or not real, meaningful or not meaningful. Jeff Ritzman was talking about going to Gettysburg, and I said, hey, you know what? There are places right by where I live where it's clear that the Anasazi or Hohokam slaughtered each other 1,000 years ago. I wonder if there's EVPs there, and if it's in some language that I don't comprehend. You know?
Yeah, that's true. I didn't think of that.
It's just, you know, those things that you go through and say, well, if this is true, then this would follow. And, you know, and then you can come back, and if you want to evade that, you could say, well, yeah, gee, Tyler, that's a good idea, but, you know, 1,000 years, that's too long. But 150 years at Gettysburg, well, that works. Well, that's crap.
Right,
that's pleading special conditions.
Moving the goalposts.
Exactly. People would call it moving the goalposts. And those are the things that we have to watch out for. Or if they happen, as we have this conversation, let's say on your webpage, you know, in the think tank, somebody could call and say, no, come on, that's special pleading. You can't do that. And then have that conversation. That's where I see that we're failing. We're not really playing fair with each other. And it may be that you'll have to find just the right people to start that. But just as you did with bringing skeptics into your show and speaking, a good example can be emulated very quickly. And it can be very powerful.
Right, exactly. I mean, I'm not afraid to talk to skeptics, like I said, because I'm not afraid to say that I'm wrong. And
yeah.
I think that, you know, well, I don't really know what I even believe anymore. So I don't even know what I'd be wrong about. You know, my real thing is that I think there's something to these mysteries, and I'd like to figure out what that is.
Yes. Why do people have these experiences? What is it? What is the basis of this? And I'll just come out there and tell you that going through some data with Project Core, certain things occurred to me. Certain things kind of fall out of the data as you look at them. And without revealing too much at this point, some of them alarmed me. And the reason is because I thought that, well, a person could take this and twist it and turn data into a pejorative to work against the people that have the experiences. And when I talked to Jeremy Vaney about that, he said, oh, yeah, I don't care, Tyler. I'd wear it as a badge of honor.
Right, because if you can, that goes back to you got to shut down the non-starters. So
yeah. That's the spirit.
Exactly. Yeah. The frustration I have is with the inability to get everybody on board this perspective. It's like, don't you really want to figure this out, or you just want to? I think too that there's a problem with just the subliminal desire to perpetuate the mystery on the part of the paranormal community, in a sense.
Well,
how many of them really want to figure this out?
And particularly if the money train depends on it, I can see that. And I think there's also a feeling that some people don't like the idea of science coming in and dissecting it and telling you, well, no, it's electrical discharge here, the temporal lobe, and obviously this is just silly. I don't think that's going to happen, first of all, but I can understand the reticence. So, and I understand that far more than I do the person on the other side who doesn't want to have the conversation. What do they have to lose?
Who's this? The skeptic or the
scientist? Yeah, the skeptic who doesn't want to get in and engage and go back and forth. What? Well, you have a lot less at stake than that. The person who's the experiencer. You know, I mean, it's silly. It's just silly. So, in my view, okay. I mean, I have to let other people explain their particular positions, and perhaps somebody will to you, and you can relay that to me.
What do you mean is silly, though? Just an ardent true believer kind of thing?
Well, the idea that if we go ahead and reduce down a phenomenon to, okay, here's what happens inside the brain. Now, let's say
I see what you're saying, yeah.
I could put you in a PET scan and go, yeah, see, you get this emanation here in the temporal lobe. It travels through the white matter back to the occipital. You get an image. It comes back. You
right.
misinterpret that. See, that's what it is.
Like the God helmet thing.
Yeah, yeah. And I'd say, well, you know what? You got that one at that moment. And it might be indicative that if you induce certain things in the brain, or the person does willfully, that you get images and experiences. So be it. And it's going to be really hard to explain whether that has any significance. In fact, I'd say it has whatever significance that person attaches to it. I know that will probably drive Jeremy Vaney nuts. But, it's part of it is that this is who we are as people, as a species. And, you know, I mean, we know that people are wired differently and they respond differently. And so we may just be finding out that there are people who are a lot more sensitive to things in the environment, and then we're trying to reduce it down. We may have missed something. So sometimes a reductionist approach doesn't tell us everything we need to know. So I look at this as a long process and a lot of back and forth and thinking and maybe arguing. And one that you have to approach like Jeremy Vaney does is without fear. This is what it means. Okay, that's who I am. Whatever. Who are you? I mean, that would be his response. I know who I am. Who are you?
Right. Well, that's the thing. I've said this on the show before. It doesn't really, if it all generates from the mind, that doesn't make it any less fantastic. That's a pretty amazing thing that you can do with your mind. And just for the, you know, for the people who desperately cling to aliens, even if it's some product of the mind, that doesn't mean that aliens can't be coming here. So, I mean, it doesn't actually negate the possibility of aliens. It just explains part of what we're dealing with.
I think you're absolutely right. And I would say, you know, think back to the Bigfoot example, that we may point out that there are weaknesses in a certain paper. That does not negate the phenomenon as a whole.
Exactly.
What is it that people see? And when I came into this, Tim, I had absolutely no interest in alien abduction, just drawn into it by accident. And now I find it very fascinating, and I really want to know what is it that people are experiencing, and how does this happen, and when, and why, and you know, what in heck goes on here? Because I'm positive that they have the experiences, and I believe them, and so I just wanted to see what we can tease out of it, if anything. And we could come back to the point and say, you know what, we're not advanced to the level where we can really get much further than this. Great. And we've gotten somewhere.
Right. So you're saying, yeah. Well, you don't really ever hear that, I guess, from with regards to the paranormal. I feel like there's also the concern that on the skeptic side, you don't really ever hear them sort of come up to the edge like that. Do you know what I mean? Where they're like, all right, I'm stumped. I'm sure there's probably some that do, but I feel like if you presented them with some case, they'd eventually come up with some prosaic. They would keep changing the goalposts in a sense, you know? Because there are really good cases out there. I don't understand. Again, it goes back to, like, I can understand why the skeptics throw out stuff that's crap. But what I don't understand is there are good stuff. So let's take the good stuff and all work together maybe on looking at that. You know, like the RB-47 case or some of these famous cases that are really, really good. Like that one over Iran or something, you know. I guess part of it, too, is I'm going to shoot my own self in the foot, but I've sort of endorsed this idea of if we're going to get back to basics, we almost have to throw out a little bit of the baby with the bathwater because the research is old now, and it's we really maybe can't get as much out of it as you would like as far as these, you know, signature cases go.
Yeah, I guess.
So we kind of have to wait around for the next signature case and actually do a better job of investigating it.
Yeah, and that's the MUFON STAR team and others, you know, more power to them. It's only literally only going to take one if there is, in fact, if the ETH is real. You know, I mean, the classic thing, well, they'll land on the White House lawn and then we'll go from there. But, yeah, if you just keep slogging at it, and I think that's a valid approach as long as people continue to have experiences, and they clearly do. They clearly see things, and some we can explain and some we can't. And that's what we got to concentrate on, is the ones that we need to work on. So I think to do otherwise is contrary to the spirit of science, just to put it out there. I mean, it's not – I wouldn't say it's unethical, but it's not the way you were trained to be as a scientist. And that method is to, you know, hey, wait a minute, what is this? And tell me again. And there's nothing wrong with asking questions. There's nothing wrong with being critical. But there is something wrong with being negative or refractory to new information. That's fatal. Not going to get us anywhere.
Right. Well, that's, I guess, the problem that the paranormalist sees happening with science, that they just outright dismiss this stuff. But I having talked to you and thought about it and having talked to Sharon and stuff, and like I said earlier, the whole thing about not producing the right data is, I think, a critical problem, you know, or not producing quality data.
We don't have, I guess, what you'd call quality data, because we don't have the smoking pistol in hand at this point. That could be that, you know, we just need to, just as you say, think about it. What could this be? What are the possibilities? I can tell you that walking out in the deserts in Arizona and looking around, I've seen the most remarkable mirages and visions. In fact, some of them are on my website. I finally got a way to record some.
Yeah.
And I mean, they're just things that they're not real. And how did this happen? And eventually we can figure out what went on. I mean, mountains that, you know, as you drive down the highway, you can see mountains appear and disappear and leap up into the sky off in the distance. It's a mirage. And I think we have a good physical basis for it. But boy, the first time you see them, they really throw you. And you have that, I know what I saw a moment. And you can, then if somebody came in and said, well, you know what, you were tripping, man. You know, you had too many mushrooms. You're on your vision quest and you got all dehydrated and you just had some kind of TIA out there. And so you don't know what you're talking about. No, I saw it. And more to the point, I photographed it. Okay. But now I'm like every other UFO investigator. I've got the photograph. And what does it tell me? Well, this one we can interpret. We kind of have some science, and so people would say, oh, yeah, that's a mirage. Okay, I get that. It's a superior image mirage. And we can, and I'm hoping that if we get enough eyeballs on the problems and enough real interaction that maybe we'll crack a few of these and say, okay, yeah, we know what that one is now. Let's move on to the next one. Or, oh, this is really interesting.
At the end of the day, no matter how dire it looks, I still kind of hope it's aliens.
Well,
I mean, I'll be honest.
It sure'd be fun if it was.
What's that?
It sure'd be fun if it was, wouldn't
it? I think that's really what drives a lot of it too. You know, it's you hope that the for the fantastical. At least I do.
Well, let me tell you, that's true of the scientists too. And I think on your website right now, isn't Bruce Priddy arguing about the SETI project in defense of SETI, or a silly effort to investigate? Is his title. Yeah, that's a classic scientific program. And guess what drives it? The hope that somebody's out there. And I mean, these are mainstream scientists, respectable people, okay? And they're thinking along these lines that out there are other civilizations who, more to the point, would be interested in trying to find out if there's anyone else out there. And what a fantastic thing it would be. You know, and every day, actually I wrote an article in the MUFON UFO Journal a few years ago about a more crowded universe. And the idea is that what we found is, as we've found, looked out into the near solar environment, there are more small red stars around us than we realized. And there may be more jumping off points, but also more points for other civilizations to possibly exist or have found refuge. And maybe one of them will signal us or maybe send a device.
I think you're one of the only handful of people who's written for both the MUFON Journal and SciScope.
Well, okay. I haven't thought of that before.
Yeah, you should find out. I bet you might be the only one. You might be the only person out there.
Well, if we put in the Journal of Biological Chemistry, we probably have a trifecta then for sure with Alzheimer's work. But these are things that I find personally fascinating, and I can tell you that so do mainstream scientists. And we may disagree about, okay, whether there's any compelling evidence. But man, you know, I'm if somebody calls me and they say, hey, there's a UFO out here, I'm out to look for it. And you know, that's the way I'm going to be until I can't get up in the night and run around anymore. Until it happens or it doesn't happen, one or the other.
Well, we need more guys like you, who are at least willing to give this a fair shake.
I think there's more out there than you may realize, and one of the problems is that
they don't want to get mixed up in the circus.
They don't want to get mixed up in the circus. It's a very strange environment for a scientist. And you probably don't think about this at all. But I come from a... Here you go. I'm the alien. I come from a world where the rules are very different, okay? And how we interact with each other is quite different than what I would see at the UFO Congress. And so when I go into the vendors area at the Alzheimer's meeting, what I will see will be the people who sell the Alzheimer's drugs and devices and things to use in the lab. But I can tell you I will not find somebody searching for implants or trying to – I don't even know what some of these people were talking about, okay, in terms of their products. Very, very strange universe there at the UFO Congress, and that is off-putting, frightening to people. And they come in and say, wow, this is pretty crazy, and that's it. They're gone.
Right.
Okay? You don't work with them. You find others and say, no, you need to focus on the talks and on the investigators and find out what's going on. And
right. You really have to separate the wheat from the chaff in this field. There's a lot of chaff.
Well, you're very kind. Yeah, I had a lot of other terms.
I guess it's like sifting for gold. That might be.
yeah.
You know, you really got to figure out. The problem with this whole thing is like, you know, in science, things get disproven, and maybe it's a handful. Maybe I don't know. Maybe you can correct me on this, but maybe. I presume maybe a handful of people who it's their pet thing kind of still hang on, but for the most part, science moves on. But, you know, with, like, for example, this Ketchum thing, I have a feeling this may go on into perpetuity. I mean, I call her the Honey Boo Boo of the paranormal. This is going to last for a long time. I feel like we're going to be talking about her, you know, in 2020 perhaps, if it keeps, because there's going to be people that will just champion stuff no matter how many times it's been disproven. No matter how many times a researcher's been discredited, people are still going to champion their stuff, you know, for God knows why. I mean, I don't even want to get into the mind of these people.
No, it could be in that things have a very long life on the Internet.
Exactly.
But, yeah, we do sometimes after long arguments, and it can be very long arguments, some matters are largely settled, but not completely. Like, does HIV virus cause AIDS? Most, I think, scientists would say, yeah, the evidence is quite compelling, but there are a few holdouts. And, I mean, climate change is another great example.
Right, yeah.
Where probably the majority consensus opinion is that carbon dioxide increasing in the atmosphere through human intervention is influencing the climate. That may be a problem for us. But there are people that vehemently disagree. But yeah, the Ketchum thing, or not to pick on her, but
right, that was just an example. I mean, I wanted to use one that is sort of the flavor of the month.
They can hang on, and you're right. People can find in there things that they think are correct and champion them. And it can be difficult because you can't always find a way to be sure that they get both sides of the story. And the other thing that we really, just as people, have to guard against is that we tend to find what we are compatible with and believe and then accept it and don't go any further. And this can lead you to errors in so many ways, whether it's political or otherwise. And so one of the things that I hope that you guys can train people to do is like Bruce with his article, is, now wait a minute, now think about this. And put those things up so there might be an alternative. And that's what I would say is that I know that there are going to be young people who are seeking, who have had experiences and are confused by them, perhaps worried about them, but trying to find more information. So I'm hoping that some of the stuff I put out there gets to them. That's all you can do. That's all you can do. I mean, the rest of it, yeah. Well, you can believe what you want to believe or find what you want to find.
Yeah. I mean, I don't fault people for believing crazy stuff. And Lord knows, we've had people on the show who believe in crazy stuff. And as much as I sort of critique the idea of speculative ufology, there's definitely a place for it.
Yeah.
But I think we need to sort of bear in mind, we can't lose focus on the ultimate quest, which is to get to the bottom of what's going on all these things.
And that's an easy thing to have happen, and particularly when turf is involved or egos or whatever. I mean, it's people are people, and it's the same in mainstream science too. If you remember Muhammad Ali, one of his things was when he was boxing as a businessman late in his career, he would win his fights by points, and people were kind of complaining, and he came out and said, "Yeah, but you got to whoop the champ. If you want to be the champ, you got to whoop me. You really got to make it clear, you know, that I couldn't compete with you." And the same is true with scientific ideas, is that there's a great deal of inertia when it comes to overthrowing them. And it can take a long time, and a lot of times it means that the old guard has to leave. But eventually it'll happen. Eventually the data will win out, even though we don't want to see it. And, you know, I was telling Jeremy and Jeff Ritzman that one of the things that happened with me going through the paranormal stuff from years ago through Paratopia and on out is that it actually taught me a little bit, I think, a better way of viewing data. And it's probably going to sound strange, but it's absolutely true, is that I am better now than I was when I first came into this at recognizing assumptions and throwing them off and saying, no, let's go where the data takes us, not using the shorthand. Do you know Alfred Lemberg?
Yes.
Alfred caught me doing something a few years ago, or he just kind of revealed, kind of offhand, something he commented, and I recognized, like, oh, crap, I'm doing that. A shorthand. And we all fall into those patterns, you know, like this guy's a jerk, that guy's okay, you know, on some trivial kind of quick decision basis. And I was quickly categorizing as to good and worthless. And he kind of caught me in a, you know, a logical quandary. I can't remember what it was now, but, you know, I really owe him one for that. I greatly appreciate that. And Jeff Ritzman and Jeremy Vaney also very patiently educated me about things. And show me, but no, Tyler, look at it, flip it this way. And so I'm a lot better now at looking at it from the opposite view. And it's actually kind of, it came up in some stuff we were doing with Alzheimer's disease, where I sat there and said, you know what, let's look at it this way. And I swear to God, believe me, don't believe me or whatever, it came from just messing around with this paranormal stuff. So, God love them. I owe Jeff and Jeremy and Alfred Lemberg something. A beer. I don't know. Something.
Jeremy doesn't drink. Believe me. I've tried.
Well, we can probably correct that eventually.
That's what I keep saying.
He'll break.
So now this is sort of like the wrap up. We'll sort of ease into the end here now. But now you've sort of been percolating, let's say, on the scene and getting more well known and doing more shows and you know, your name's getting out there more and more, and you know, let's just, regardless of the people who won't listen, because, you know, if they won't listen, then that's fine. There's nothing we can do without those people. So they can do whatever they want. I was gonna say something more crass, but we'll just say they can do whatever they want. What's, you know, where do you see your work going from here? You know, because I want more from you. I mean, you got, like, maybe a blog, or, you know, if we're working on a blog set up at Banal of America, you know, you come over here and write for us, or, you know, what, or a book or something, you know, what kind of stuff are you thinking about maybe doing down the line? Because, you need more of a presence in this field, man.
Well, a blog might be kind of fun. To be really honest, the thing that I really want to finish right now is the Project Core with Jeff and Jeremy. This is really Jeff's and Jeremy's idea, and I'm just helping them out. But I would like to go ahead and look at that data, compare it to things like Whitley Strieber and the things that Denise Stoner and Kathleen Martin put out. And God bless them, they put it out there for everybody to see. Their survey.
Right, yeah, they've done some good work too, yeah.
Yeah, and that was nice, because one of the criticisms I've had is, well, yeah, you can have it if you buy it. You know, that's how I would look at the field, and they didn't play that game. And so I'm very grateful for that. But that's what I would like to do right now is just see what we can tease out of Project Core. My friend at school, Dr. Kim Cooper, has a student who's actually reducing some of the data, and we've got quite a few stories, into a computer friendly Excel kind of format. And then I've gone through and found some things I think are kind of interesting. But apart from that, I don't have any plans. I mean, I'm fine just coming on in podcasts or whatever. I don't need to need anything beyond that. And I'm in a really great position because I have a job that pays me a living wage, so this can be the stuff I just love to do and mess around with it.
I think that helps, because I'm kind of in the same position, you know, where it's like, if you can kind of really keep this at arm's length, it is, I think, a healthier perspective on the whole thing.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I sort of dabbled with the possibility of you know, becoming a paranormalist as a career. But then I remembered I went to college. No, I'm... but it's really, you know, I think that I've always said, you know, I try to be sort of in the paranormal, but not necessarily of the paranormal.
Sure, I know exactly what you're doing, yeah.
Because if you can get that separation, I think you have a much better way of looking at all this. Because otherwise, you know, if you have to sing for your supper in this field, then it skews the whole operation.
Yes. Yes. And it gives you a great deal of, I guess, powerful latitude You know, you have a perspective that maybe others don't, and needs that don't drive you in certain directions. This is where you can go where the data lets you go. And basically say, that doesn't work for me, or that's, I'm sorry, that's wrong. And be able to say it just in an instant.
So, yeah.
Nope, not working.
All right, so folks should just stay tuned. Keep a Google alert on Tyler Coach on, because they'll be popping up in various places. And
well, you know, the greatest tool in the universe, Twitter.
You really like the Twitter? I can't get into it. See how bad I am? I call it the Twitter.
Twitter.
Yeah.
What I've done is I follow people that are interesting, and it's really a chance to interact with people. If they are kind enough to put out, I guess, advance notice of what they're doing or their articles or whatnot, and you can shoot them right then and there if you want to.
What do you mean shoot them?
If they have something stupid.
Oh, that's what you say, huh?
You can come back and say, yeah, but you forgot about this. And boop, there it is. And so it's a little more public than sending an email that they just delete.
Yeah.
And for the most part, I think that, as with anything else, you need to be basically fundamentally positive. But you can give them some gas and get your point across to people that might not otherwise want to talk to you very much. But the other thing is that you can also have a pulse for what's going on. So I can pop into Twitter and see what the issues are right away. And, you know, what's kind of hitting right now. That's how I got onto the Bigfoot thing. And, started to track that. And that's actually where I first, saw, Sharon Hill, Doubtful News, and I just followed her.
Yeah, she's done some great work on that story.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's brilliant. It's brilliant. And other people had contributed. And together, to me, that shows what the field can do. That the field, that disparate people came together. Sharon Hill from the skeptical side, the Randy Foundation, and then some of the other bloggers, Bigfoot people, came together and they exposed the problems. Very short order, but very effectively. And I mean, this is the way it should work.
I agree, though. Yeah, it's a good sign the way that whole thing unfolded. That there was sort of a collective cooperation, you know.
It was.
Yeah.
But the other thing is that it wasn't just the skeptics screaming foul. The Bigfoot researchers got in there and said, "Yeah, you know what? This doesn't work." Yeah, and they were retweeting stuff, you know, the comments, criticisms, or whatever. These are the Bigfoot guys. The ones that you would think would be, you know, closing ranks, no. They wanted the quality data. Well, good for them.
Right. Well, that's, I guess, how I can, beyond separating the wheat from the chaff, I guess that's how you can separate the, you know, the people who are really looking to get to the bottom of this, the people who are rather just propagate the mythos.
Or you could say, well, they're propagating whatever they propagate, but they went ahead and made sure that everybody that followed them knew what was going on here. You know, I'm not saying that every site that I've followed there or looked at is necessarily, you know, the be-all and end-all of scientific integrity. They are what they are, but they did a great job here. And so I'd say, yeah, that's pretty cool. That's more power to you.
Let's hope it continues.
I'm hoping it will. I think it will because I think people see good possibilities here. And some of them, I mean, I'm sure a lot of them are probably unhappy.
With that it didn't work out?
No, the idea that skeptics would collude with
yes.
researchers.
It's a conspiracy, yes.
And come together and, you know, destroy a great myth. And it was a beautiful myth. I mean, it was a great example of how you can solve these problems and come up with explanations that work so well until you start to examine them. So, yeah, this is why you need peer review. Now, it's not going to solve everything, but it's certainly a good start.
In a way, it was kind of like a quasi version of peer review.
It was. It is. And it is.
Or like a democratized sort of non-scientific, scientific in a way, I guess, non institutionalized scientific peer review.
That's what I would say. An informal but very scientific at its heart process.
Yeah.
And people, if you come in and you look at some of the postings on Doubtful News, what you'll see is that many of the commenters were very sage. And I look at Guy Edwards' site, and I also see there are a lot of people in there that had really important insights to offer. That's peer review, pure and simple. It's exactly, I mean, it's so great because this whole system, there's no way to do it, and we found a way to do it. How about that?
There you go, folks. The future looks bright, perhaps.
Sort of.
Yeah.
We'll find a way to mess it up, Tim.
Yeah, give it time. Give it time. And on that note, you've given us a tremendous amount of time. I think you managed to break Paul Kimball's record here for longest appearance this season. So
cool.
Yeah, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it. I've said numerous times this year, you know, I can't believe we've gone 2 hours. We've gone so long, but I mean, we've gone over 3 hours here, and I'm stunned because I feel like if it wasn't 2:17 in the morning in Boston, and if you probably, you know, if you didn't have a life, I would, I think we'd both be on the phone, you know, for another 2 or 3 hours. So I figure it's only a matter of time before that happens in the future.
Okay.
And on that note, I love this conversation. I'm going to keep an eye out on your stuff, and we're going to be emailing back and forth all the time, and. Are you not on the Facebook, though?
I don't have anything to post there, and I've just never been interested in being on it. The only thing that would make me do that is, like, Rogan and archivist people have stuff there, and Jeremy does. So, no, I don't see that, but maybe I should just get an account and just have my name on it.
I think it might be a good idea, but, you know, who knows? I think you'd get a whole new insight into this, you know? Because you don't have a web hub, so
yeah,
you don't get the opportunity to be harassed or harangued.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's a double-edged sword. So, you know, you might be in the exact right position. Because there have certainly been times when I think to myself, if I had just sort of hung back on the periphery, I might be happier with the field or something like that. So, you know.
I don't know. I think, you know, you've got a good job or a good gig here going.
I'm happy
with it,
yeah.
Yeah, and you got some interesting people, and they're not all saying the same things. You know, there's a diversity there, and that's key. So, yeah, if you can tolerate that kind of ambiguity, I think, you know, you're going to last and do well. And I think data suggests that that is the case. Within all of America, so.
Awesome. That's from a real scientist, folks.
Well, sort of.
Okay.
As best I can. Remember,
yeah.
We're practicing, you know, and we get in there and we don't know the answers. This is the kind of disappointing thing, is that research is about trying to find out and having reasonable ideas that fail, and then you move on. And that's why they put the re in research.
There you go. I never thought of it that way. That's not true, though, is it?
It is.
I guess, yeah, you search and then you research. Yeah, I guess that is true, yeah.
It really is. And if you're, if
I just
you
thought
know
that might have been like an old axiom or something.
Well, in a way, but if you know all the answers in advance, it's not research. And so we are expected to go ahead and project problems, look at issues, potential things that could arise, show how we get around those. But the bottom line is that we need to advance the knowledge. And so if we don't put something of significance on the table, my colleagues will not allow that to proceed. So you've got to push the knowledge back a little bit, but just a little bit. If you go too far, if you push too far, if you get too radical, there's a thing called the tyranny of peer review, and it will tend to make the too far ideas fail. And so it's very conservative, too. So that's why I say peer review is good, but it won't necessarily answer all the questions. We need some high-quality thinking and a lot of voices, a lot of ideas. And so that's what I see Banal of America contributing.
Well, thank you very much, sir. It's been a real pleasure. And like I said, I can't believe it's so late in the morning. This has been quite the conversation. And I can guarantee you this is not the last time you'll be on the program. I look forward to doing this again in the future.
Okay, great.
that does it for this edition of BOA Audio Season 7. Big, big thanks to Dr. Tyler Cokejohn for coming on the show and giving us so much time. You can find out more from him at twitter.com/TylerCokejohn. And you spell that TylerCokejohn. Check it out. Moving right along now, it is time for BOA Audio Listener Feedback, but because this episode is, once again, long overdue, I'm going to eschew listener feedback here this week. I hate to do it 2 weeks in a row, but I want to get this episode out to folks as soon as possible, and it has been delayed by about at least a week to 10 days, so let's skip listener feedback here once again this week. I promise I will bring it back on the next installment of BOA Audio, and I'm going to do my very best to make sure the wait is not nearly as long as it has been for this episode. With that said, now is the time in the season where I turn to the BOA Audio listeners and ask you to send us your guest suggestions for the next season of the program. If you look back in the archive of Banal of America Audio, it is littered with guest suggestions from the BOA Audio listeners. Some of the very strongest episodes actually came from BOA Audio listeners, such as our good friend Bruce Rux, who was recommended by USOV.com member Lone Gunman. So the very fabric of BOA Audio is comprised of guest suggestions from the listeners, and now is the time in the season where you have the best chance of getting to hear your guest suggestion on the next series of programs from Banal of America Audio. So, feel free to send me your guest suggestions for BOA Audio Season 8, and of course, feel free to send me your correspondences and thoughts on the program. How do you get a hold of me? That's simple. Just write to boaaudio@hotmail.com or head on over to banalofamerica.com, B-I-N-N-A-L-L ofamerica.com, and click the contact button. And if you want something a little more interactive, you can join up at the official BOA forum, theusofe.com, theusofe.com. And if you don't want to write all those letters down, just click the forum button at Banal of America. We like to call it BOA's Paranormal Playground, where we discuss the world of esoterica, as well as sports and pop culture. Join us, would you, at the US of E. Additionally, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter by punching in Binall, B-I-N-N-A-L-L. That'll bring up my profile on those social network sites. Feel free to befriend me, follow me, or poke me. It's all good, and I'd be happy to have you as part of my online circle of friends. And finally, there is, of course, Banal of America on Facebook. That's pretty simple to find. You just punch in Banal of America on Facebook. That'll bring up the page. It's also linked on my profile. We are currently at 978 likes, so we are just a mere 22 likes away from the long-anticipated 1,000th like. Of course, whoever is that very lucky person will get a shout-out here at the end of the program. So, if you've not liked us yet on Facebook, do so, please. It would be greatly appreciated. Up next, please allow me to take a moment and thank the outstanding and esteemed BOA staff, Leslie, Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Richard Thomas, Marla Pena, Bruce Pretty, Tony Morrill, our webmaster Ray Weigel, and our graphics guru Jeremy Boston. I've been teasing you here at the end of the show about BOA 3.0. It is getting very, very close, my friends. I'd like to really have it coincide with the season finale of BOA Audio Season 7, so hopefully just a few short weeks away. It's looking good. I'm very excited about it. I can't really tell you too much more other than It is getting very close to the unveiling. So, as always, stay tuned to Banal of America. Now comes the time in the program where I pass the basket around to the BOA audio listeners and ask you to make a donation to the Banal of America franchise. How do you do that? That is simple. Just head on over to Banal of America and click the PayPal button. That'll take you to PayPal. They'll walk you through the process. It's safe, secure, and simple. But what if you don't trust the internet and you want to make a snail mail donation? Well, you're in luck because we have a P.O. box for just that very reason. You can mail your donation to Tim Banal, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, Mass., 01866. And the complete address, of course, can be found at banalofamerica.com, right under the PayPal button. As always, it bears repeating, my friends, no donation is too small, and all donations go towards Banal of America and BOA Audio to keep the entire franchise up and running, freely available, and commercial free for all of our great readers and listeners the world over. On the next edition of the program, we are going to delve into a mystery that I have wanted to explore on BOA Audio for years. I am talking about the mystery of Amelia Earhart. Our guest will be Carol Lynn Dow, author of the book The Lost Flight of Amelia Earhart, and it is an in-depth conversation about the Amelia Earhart mystery, folks. This one is a barn burner. What may have gone wrong on her global flight, and what possibly became of Amelia Earhart? I'm not going to give away Carol's theory on the ultimate fate of Amelia Earhart, but it is riveting, folks, and it is really compelling stuff. We're not just going to get into Carol's theory, we're also going to look at all of the various other theories surrounding the fate of Amelia Earhart. This is classic unsolved mysteries, sightings type material, and a topic that I have been dying to discuss here on the program, and finally we'll get the chance to explore this mystery with Carol Lynn Dow, author of The Lost Flight of Amelia Earhart. That's on the next edition of BOA Audio. And on that note, we close the book on this installment of the program. Big, big thanks to Dr. Tyler Cokejohn for coming on the show. And, of course, enormous thanks to all you folks out there, the hardcore BOA Audio listeners, the folks who have supported us episode to episode, season to season, and year to year. You are the lifeblood of this program, and I cannot thank you enough for your enduring support of BOA. Thank you once again for making Banal of America Audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. Until next time, this is Tim Banal, thanking you for listening and signing off.